My name is Tink Tinker, and the title of this session is Native American or American Indian Theology, Part 1, and it'll continue Friday in another session. And we're dealing today predominantly with American Indian spirituality, issues of Indian spirituality. I'm currently associate professor of multicultural ministries at the United Methodist Seminary in Denver, Iliff School of Theology, and part-time pastor of Living Waters American Indian Ministry, which is a ministry of the Rocky Mountain Synod ELCA. I'm an ELCA pastor, trained initially in the Missouri Synod, and eventually at PLTS in Berkeley, and in Bible at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, with a PhD in 1983. But what I've done with my life since I finished the degree in Bible is really to abandon Bible as an academic area, and to spend most of my energies in trying to sort out issues that relate to American Indian peoples and come between Indian peoples and white peoples. As I said yesterday in the session, I'm mixed blood. I'm Indian on my father's side and a Lutheran pastor on my mother's side. So I have a foot in both worlds, as it were. Yet one can't live with a foot in both worlds because the cultures are so different. And one gets torn apart trying to keep a foot in both worlds. Some years ago, the Onondagas retrieved the Iroquois Confederacy under the leadership of the Onondagas, retrieved a treaty belt, a wampum belt, from a museum in New York. I can't remember if it was a state museum or a federal museum. But they won the right to have that treaty belt returned to them. And it was kind of cute because they wouldn't give them the belt back until they built a climate-controlled museum to house this belt. And the belt is different colors of shell beads strung on leather. The first thing the Onondagas did when they got the belt back was take one look at it and say, it's in serious disrepair. And they scrapped all the old leather and replaced it with new leather. But on this treaty belt, it was the first treaty between the Iroquois Confederacy and the invading Europeans. They agreed to live in peace with one another. They agreed that both of them would share the land, and the treaty belt shows two boats passing. It's about that thick, maybe about that long as I recall, and beaded on there are two boats going in different directions. That's the treaty. And as the Onondagas interpret the treaty, the truth of the treaty is we can both be here, but we can't share one another's culture, because you can't have a foot in both boats. They're going in different directions, and you're going to end up in the water. An interesting thought, but a lot of people have wondered why I've chosen to follow my father's people more than my mother's way. Well, I followed my mother's way through seminary and into a PhD, and I guess it's only fair that I spend a certain amount of time paying attention to my father's way. Living Waters Ministry is a ministry to Indian people, conducted by Indian people, supported by the ELCA and the Rocky Mountain Synod. A ministry which has continued to evolve. It's actually the second Indian ministry I've started. I started Bay Area Native American Ministry, where Paul Schultz is currently holding down the fort. I don't know if you all know Paul. Some of you will remember him from NILP days. Full-blooded Ojibwe with a Lutheran name. Living Waters reaches out to a community in Denver. And remember, American Indians are only about 1% of the U.S. population. A population in Denver that is substantial given those parameters of relativity, but which is also substantially poor. Nationwide unemployment among Indian people is about 60%. Some reservations, it's as high as 90 and 92% in chronic. It's not a seasonal fluctuating number. Indian people are economically the poorest of all ethnic groups in the United States, including New Asian refugees. Just to give you an idea what the ministry is up against and what we deal with. On a typical Sunday, 30 to 40% of the people who gather at Living Waters are out of work. And I would say probably 60% of those who gather are in some stage of addictions recovery process from alcohol abuse. And the extensive alcoholism among Indian people is one of the signifiers of the poverty and the state of colonization of Indian peoples. It's easy enough to say they're just drunk Indians. It's another thing to ask why. What's caused the current situation to become so degraded. One of the things Living Waters has tried to do over the past 10 years is to give support to Indian people in the community who find their spiritual sustenance in traditional ways rather than in, you know, missionized Christian ways. So that we've had close connection over the years with a variety of medicine people. Most recently, one of my cousins has become a medicine person and has developed a relationship with Living Waters Ministry. So that many of those who come to Living Waters either use our facilities or participate in our prayers are people who participate regularly in traditional ways back in their home reservations, or even in Denver, where we try and do some things to maintain those connections with home, so that people might go home for participation in Blessing Way or one of the other major sings among the Navajo, or they may go back to Oklahoma for a green corn dance, or for some other spring or solstice ceremonial, and they might participate in one of a variety of sun dances that many of the Plains tribes still participate in. Many of the people at Living Waters will, for instance, keep a pipe in their homes for prayers. This is what we call a sacred pipe. We don't tend to call them peace pipes. The U.S. military coined the term peace pipe because the only time they ever saw one was when there was a treaty to be signed. Actually, that same pipe gets smoked before a tribe goes to war, so you might as well call it a war pipe. It marks any sacred activity. And in the course of any given month in Denver, people might participate in one or more what we call purification rites, a rite that involves heating stones, bringing them inside a darkened lodge. And people have often asked me if it isn't something like a sauna. And I suppose it has some structural similarities to a sauna, but I've always said that I, at least, had never prayed in a sauna. And the Anipi ceremony, the purification ceremony, is a rite of prayer. Well, that's some of the things that I wanted you to know before we start. I myself have necessarily participated in these ceremonies, both in Denver and on a variety of reservations. Most recently, I was home on my own reservation for Ilonska, the spring solstice ceremonial renewal ceremony that the Neokoshka, or the Osage, perform each year, a four-day ceremony. I'm hoping that once we get into some of the substance of what I have to say, that it will spark some conversation among us. And in particular, I'd like to have some conversation about, you know, what this talk, this conversation about Indian spirituality, what it might say to us as Lutherans, to stand on my other foot for a moment. What does it say to us as Lutherans about our own spirituality, and what can we learn from it? Where do we get into trouble by misappropriating that which shouldn't be appropriated? And I've asked Susan and David Sherwin to kind of be a panel to prompt that discussion and to respond to some of the things that I have to say at some point, and to get you all involved in the conversation as well. So I'm going to speak for about 40 minutes, now about 30 minutes, I guess, and then ask them to respond a little bit, and then we're going to get all of you involved in the conversation, because I like a two-hour block instead of a one-hour block, not so that I can talk more, but so that we can get involved in some conversation together about these things. So I'm going to start with a couple of stories. The first one is a true story, similar to the one I told Susan and David over lunch. It's about a Plains Indian chief who was carted off to Washington, D.C. a century and a quarter ago in order to negotiate new land cessions from his tribe. The way that was done was the government would bring the chiefs into Washington, and once they had them in Washington, would try to impress them with the size of the city and with the power of the government, with the magnificence of the buildings. Would also dress them in a new set of clothes. You know, give them a three-piece suit, a shirt and a tie, tuck their braids inside the waistcoats so that they looked more civilized and more human than they would otherwise. And then they would have a large feast where they would feed this Indian delegation, whether it's one or several people, to impress them with the kinds of culinary arts that were practiced in those days in what was called civilized society. So there was a variety of food. Well, here's your first cultural difference. Indian people tend not to talk when they eat. When there's food in front of them, it's time to eat. James R. Walker, a physician at Pine Ridge Reservation back at the turn of the century, entertained many traditional people trying to gather ethnographic information from them. The Indians always found him a curious fellow because he would bring them in to feed them and ply them with questions all the way through. One of them said, "You pester us so much with questions while we're eating that we can't eat. And when we're finally done eating and are ready to talk, you shove us out the door and tell us good night." So this chief is eating at this feast in his honor. And some undersecretary in charge of Indian affairs was sitting across from him, trying to make small talk to make the evening interesting. And through an interpreter, he said to him, failing at all other conversation, finally, "Gee, Chief, I sure," watching him eat, "Gee, Chief, I sure wish I had your appetite." Chief kept eating while it was translated to him. He didn't look up, just grabbed some more of the fried chicken as it came by and took some more of the corn. He was continuing to eat, and as he finished his chicken and was reaching for a piece of the roast beef as it went by, he finally looked up at that man. He said, "You stole our land." Helped himself to some mashed potatoes and some gravy, some of the peas that came by. There was carrots and raisins too, just for Dave's sake. And as he was finishing that up and stabbing a piece of meatloaf as it went by and a pork chop, he looked up again. And he said, at this point, Undersecretary is pretty intimidated. He knows he's going to get his way in the treaty anyway. He looked up and said, "You killed all our buffalo," and went back to eating. And as he finally finished his meal, sopping up the last of his turkey gravy and dressing with a piece of bread and wiping his plate clean the way Indian people will, because you leave a clean plate. Finally looked up at that undersecretary and said to him, "And now you want my appetite." Second story is a traditional story. And I'm borrowing it from a friend of mine that some of you here in the Northwest may know, Terry Tafoya, a psychologist who taught at Evergreen State for a while and now is in private practice somewhere in or outside of Seattle. He's a Taos and Warm Springs Indian from mixed parentage. So this is a Northwestern story. And it's a story about Crane and Bear. Bear decided to have a feast. So he invited all of his relatives to come to the feast, and they were all there. Deer, elk, squirrel, eagle, crane, they were all there. The lodge was just packed, and the food was laid out around the fire the way it was supposed to. And people looked, and they looked, just about everything was there that they possibly could want, except there was no oil. And they began to grumble and complain and began to say, "Bear doesn't know how to have a feast. Bear doesn't know how to be generous. Bear doesn't know how to treat his relatives." And Bear got gruff and angry and began to growl and say, "What do you mean? Bear doesn't know how to treat his relatives. If Bear's not generous, that Bear doesn't know how to have a feast." They said, "Well, there's no water." And Bear harumphed and said, "Well, I'll show you that Bear does know how to have a feast. That Bear does know how to be generous. That Bear does know how to treat his relatives." And he began to sing his song and dance his dance. And as he did, held his hands out over the fire, had a little bowl set next to him, and as he was dancing and singing, wiping his hands together, rubbing them over the fire, and as he finally finished his song, he brought his hands over that bowl and squeezed his hands and filled that bowl with oil. Crane was just super impressed and decided that he too was going to have a feast. And he too was going to invite all his relatives to come. And when they got there, they found the same thing. The lodge had food spread out everywhere. The lodge was filled with relatives. But again, there was no oil. They began to complain that Crane didn't know how to have a feast. That Crane didn't know how to treat his relatives. That Crane didn't know how to be generous. Crane said, "Aha! So I'll show you that Crane knows how to treat his relatives, how to be generous, how to have a feast." So he began to hold his hands out over the fire and began singing, "Ha hey, ha hey, ha ha, hey, ha ha, hey, ha." And as he finished the song, he took his hands over that bowl and just squeezed them and smiled. "Ha hey, ha hey, ha." Nothing came out, right? So he's sitting there putting them back on, sang the song again and again. And the fourth time he sang the song, his hands got so hot and so burned that he went running out of the lodge and jumped into the nearest creek, where you can still find Crane standing trying to cool off his hands. And you'll see that he's black all the way down to water level to this day from that experience. Dr. Tafoya uses that story in order to help people understand you've got to know your own song. You can't borrow someone else's. In the Northwestern tradition, songs are an individual thing. Every person has their own song. And there's no spiritual power in singing someone else's song. But you must go through the suffering, the sacrifice, the trouble, the effort of getting your own song. Remember that as we continue. It's going to be important. So there are a couple of things that I want to leave you with about Indian spirituality. The first is, if I can talk in broad generalities about Indian spirituality, but in particular about one or two, a couple of different tribes. Because each tribe is different, but there are some generalities that tie us together the way there are some generalities in Europe that tie European cultures together. And I guess the first thing that I'd have to say is that we tend to think in terms of dualities. Wakunda is one. That much is clear. When the first missionaries came to the Osages, and said to the Osages, you've been worshiping the wrong God. The apocryphal response that gets told back on the reservation to this day is that the Osages responded by saying, you mean there's more than one? Wakonda is one. We're clear about that. But Wakonda in Indian theology is very, very complex. Wakonda is not knowable. Wakonda is a mystery. Gets translated usually great spirit. You've heard Indian terms for God translated as great spirit. I know on Indian Concern Sunday in the Lutheran Church, there used to be litanies published in the bulletin that that called upon God as great spirit. Isn't that strike you as just a little bit simplistic and childish? And it always reflects on the childishness of Indian people, not the childishness of the missionaries who interpreted that way. Well, Wakonta is best translated instead of great spirit. Not even in this case great mystery, but it builds on the term Wakon, the sacred mystery. The sacred mystery is Wakonda, and it's unknowable. It's only knowable when Wakonda has no gender, no form, no shape. It's not a white-haired, bearded man in heaven waiting to answer our prayers. It, because it has no gender, only becomes knowable when it chooses to manifest itself to the world. And typically, Wakonda, or Orendi, or Gitche Manitou, or Wakantanka, chooses to manifest itself as a duality, as two. Not as three, but as two. Initially, in most tribes, as above and below. So that Osage prayers begin, Wakonda Monchiti, Wakonda Utseta, Wakonda above, Wakonda below, symbolized by sky and earth, and called upon as grandfather and grandmother. Because to call upon God only as He would, in the Indian mind, be totally insufficient, incomplete, unbalanced, disharmonious, so that there has to be both male and female that are a part of that reciprocal dualism. Now you'll notice immediately that's different from the dualism that's in European history and Near Eastern history, the dualism that was a part of forming the New Testament in particular, the dualism of Gnosticism, one of the heresies that the early church had both to respond to and in some cases wholeheartedly adopted. It's not a dualism of opposites, of good and evil, night and day, dark and light. But it's a dualism instead of two things that are necessary in order for there to be a balanced whole. So there has to be sky and earth, male and female, above and below. There has to be this coming together of that duality in order for there to be wholeness. My friend Alfonso Ortiz at the University of New Mexico from San Juan, Tewa peoples, has insisted that the most important number for Indian peoples is not two, but four. That Indian people are, in Alfonso's words, relentlessly tetradic, as opposed to Trinitarian. Because those dualities play out in ways that eventually end up being fours. So that we can talk about sky and earth, but Osages only begin with Wakonda Monchita and Wakonda Udseta. We immediately incorporate the Wakonda of the day and the Wakonda of the night, the sun and the moon, so that immediately there are four. At Living Waters, when we begin our prayers, we always begin with a song called the Four Directions Song. So we begin singing to each of the directions, summoning Wakonda's power as it has made itself manifest in each of the four directions, so that we see Wakonda's power coming to us for different purposes and in different ways from the different directions. Call upon the east, for instance, where the sun rises, for that particular power that nurtures childbirth and infancy. Also call upon it for that power which nurtures wisdom in the community. Maybe I can sketch it out here for us a little bit. We call that wisdom. Call upon the Wakonda to come from the south, because that power brings us the spirit of generosity, and the particular gift of holding communities together. Community building centers around this gift of generosity. Call upon the Wakonda from, and I'm simplifying this, this stands for a whole set of virtues or powers that come from those directions. The Wakonda from the west brings courage. The Wakonda from the north brings strength. Along with courage and strength come particular kinds of healing powers. From the west comes the power of purification. You know, the rains, the thunder, the lightning comes from the west and purifies the community, purifies the world. And from the north too comes a different kind of healing and a different kind of purification. The purification, the annual purification of winter, of cold, the whiteness of snow and ice that lends itself to purifying the world in a different way. So that when we start, we call upon God to come to us from those four directions. But we also call upon God, and it's curious that one misguided Osage, not a traditional Osage, but a would-be Osage scholar. That's admitted, he's a cousin of mine. Told me a few years ago that the difference between the Osages and the Sioux is that for the Sioux the sacred number is 7 and for Osages it's 4. I just suggest to him that he was misinformed, because the Sioux, you know, the Four Directions song we sing is actually a Sioux song. But the Four Directions song has 6 verses. Go figure, huh? Except that once you've sung to the Four Directions, then you sing to the above and the below, just like in Osage way. So that 4 becomes 6. 2 became 1 became 2, and 2 became 4, and 4 became 6, and now 6 is going to become 7. Because when we load a pipe, and whether it's Osage way or Lakota way, you know, we pray to the four directions with each piece of tobacco that we put in the pipe, each pinch, we say a prayer to one of the directions, to the above and to the below, and then the seventh pinch is for the center of the universe. And the center of the universe is where you are when you're praying. It's not located on the Black Hills or Lake Chelan or north of Tulsa, or it's where you are at the time that you pray. And that's the seventh pinch of tobacco. So that we've gone from one to two to four to six and to seven. And it's interesting that the Osages are divided into two groups. Now, every Osage village is divided into the Honkas and the Tsishos, with the Honkas to the south and the Tsisho to the north, with a road through the town that goes from east to west. That's a Z, I didn't make it very good. And the Honkas are represented by the number seven, and the Tsishos by the number six, so that in Osage symbology, they're always 13. So because you have six and seven, and eventually you end up with 13. So you can see that my cousin was wrong about saying Osages only honor the number four, because we honor the number six and seven as much as any other tribe in North America, and eventually end up with 13. So that the symbol of the sun shining on the world always comes with 13 rays, and there are always 13 war honors, whether they're Tsisho or Hunka war honors. There are 13 war honors that can be achieved by an Osage person. In all of this, the most important thing about Indian spirituality is that it's done for the sake of the community. It's never done for the sake of one's own spiritual enrichment. And I think that's a decided difference from where Christianity has ended up 2,000 years after Jesus and after the writing of the New Testament. In the world around us, in North America in particular, over the past 300 years, it's a phenomenon that has developed that's new to Christianity. It's called volunteerism. That is, each one of us gets to decide what church we're going to belong to, right? You get to decide if you're going to be Lutheran or Methodist or Catholic. You get to decide if you're Lutheran, whether to go to this church or that church. Whether to go to Our Savior's or Good Shepherd or Christ the King or Our Redeemer. typical Lutheran names that probably appear in every major city in North America. That's called volunteerism. You have a choice. In the Indian world, you don't have a choice. You're born Osage. Either, first of all, I'm born Osage. I can't suddenly decide next week to try out being Hopi. Right? I mean, that'd be like a Swede trying out being a Norwegian. So I'm an Osage. I'm born that way. My participation in the ceremonial life of the people is predicated upon my birth. Now, as an Osage, I also am either Tsisho or Hunka. And as one of those divisions, I participate in the ceremonies in a particular way, because the ceremony, even though it's a tribal ceremony, will be either a Hunka or a Tsisho ceremony. If it is a war ceremony, for instance, it's always a Hunka ceremony, never Tsisho, because the Tsishos... Is there an eraser?
There's a cloth up here, I think.
A table napkin. The Tsishos are symbolized by peace, while the Hunkas are symbolized by war. So that the peace chief is always a Tsisho and the war chief is always a Hunka. So that if it's a war ceremony, it's always a Hunka ceremony, which doesn't mean that Tsishos don't participate, because we Tsishos are not excused from being warriors on a war party. It's expected that we will do that as much as anyone else. It's that our ceremonial life is given over to the peace ceremony rather than the war ceremony. So that when an encounter starts, the ceremony is performed for the tribe by the Hunkas, and it's performed for the whole tribe, not just for the Hunkas. And when we return from an encounter, the peace ceremony, which is a cleansing ritual, a purification, in order to put aside our having participated in acts that were a violation of the sacred, the peace ceremony is coordinated by the Tsishos for the whole tribe, for everyone. So that I can't wake up, if I'm Tsisho, I can't wake up one morning and decide I want to try out being Hunka for a while and see what that's like. I was at a Sundance in South Dakota where they allow whites to participate, and there was a woman there who was dancing in her fourth Sundance, white woman, and she announced to a small group that she wouldn't be back the next year because she was going to London instead to find out what the Rastafarians are all about. That's kind of like spiritual scalp collecting, isn't it? Try out one thing and then another. Well, as an Osage, I can never try out what it's like to be a Hunka. The anthropologist can come in and say, I have a right to know everything about you. I even have a right to know things about you that you don't know yourself. See, but I don't have a right to know what the Hunka's involvement in the ceremony is. I only have a right to be there when they perform the ceremony. So that the well-being of the whole tribe is predicated on the participation of every group within the tribe. Within these two divisions, there are 24 clans. And those 24 clans each have their own participation in those ceremonies, in their own separate ceremonies for the whole. So that a successful ceremony requires the appropriate participation of every clan in its own way. And if a clan isn't present, then we've got to rethink the ceremony, whether we can even do the ceremony, because none of us know what that clan was supposed to do. Only that clan knows. They're the ones who are privileged in that regard. There's so much that needs to be said and so little time to say it. At Living Waters, when we participate in these things, all of this symbolism takes on meaning for us that cannot be displaced by any Christian or Lutheran commitment. In other words, our Lutheranism has to somehow fit into who we are. The old missionary scheme of removing our culture, and that's what it is to remove our religious attachments, and replace it with something Lutheran in Christian, simply will not work anymore. People around the world, not just Indian people, but other indigenous peoples, are going to be too firm in saying, we want to have the freedom to determine the gospel for ourselves. So that Indian people at Living Waters are going to insist that it's important for them to take off in the middle of the summer, for instance, to go off to Southern Ute Reservation or Pine Ridge or Rosebud Reservation or any of a number of other reservations where sun dances are performed in order to dance for the sake of the people. They're going to insist on participating in ceremonies that the missionaries and the anthropologists and government officials have consistently called rituals of self-torture and self-mutilation. In the summer of 1995, these things are happening still. Typically, when someone makes the commitment to perform this sun dance, it's a matter of committing yourself to about 10 days. Now, this person may not go to church every Sunday. I have a lot of trouble convincing Indian people that they need to make an every Sunday commitment. I began to tell you that it's hard for me to make a commitment to seminary chapel twice a week because it's a half hour out of my life each time that is a lot of time. And when I'm committed to once a week or twice a week participating in a purification ceremony that's going to take 5 to 6 hours each time, that extra half hour is pretty hard for me to give up in the middle of the day. But when we do, you know, performing an ipi, or performing purification ceremony, means taking the time to leave the city, to go out to a place where we have a lodge set up, building a fire, heating the rocks, and then eventually, you know, you sit and wait for the rocks to heat up for a couple or 3 hours. When you bring them in the lodge, they're red hot. My son, first time he went in, he was about 5 years old, and I tried to warn him that it's going to be so dark you can't see your hand in front of your face. That particular day, the rocks were so hot that you could have read a book inside the lodge. And he was convinced I'd lied to him. I've never been in a sauna as hot as, you know, the anthropologists call this the sweat lodge. I've never been in a sauna this hot. 4 rounds. In a sauna, typically you spend 10 minutes. I've been in a sweat ceremony as long as 5 hours. And Osages, in the old days, had all-night sweat lodge ceremonies. You need a long drink of water when you come out of there. I mean, we're talking serious self-sacrifice, and it really is self-sacrifice. The sun dance is ultimately 4 hard days of dancing out of the 10 days total. 4 hard days of dancing from sunup to sundown. 4 days with no food and no water. That's self-sacrifice. And in some ceremonies, the men, even still today, will be pierced and tied to the tree through the skin on their chest or their back and will dance until that breaks. Some of them for 4 days will dance until it breaks, for 4 days tied to the tree. This is serious self-sacrifice. You can see why Christian missionaries called it self-torture and self-mutilation. But in each case, it's done by these individuals with one thing in mind, that the people might live. That the people might live. It's always done for the community, for the good of the whole, and for the community right there. So when somebody flies in from Denmark to dance the sun dance, they're dancing for the people of Rosebud. Why did they fly in from Denmark to dance for the people at Rosebud? Surely they're not dancing for people in Denmark. People in Denmark aren't, you know, just sitting with bated breath to find out how the sun dance at Rosebud went so that they know, you know, how their harvest is going to go this year or whether there are going to be plenty of animals to hunt this winter. It's a curiosity that escapes me. The sweat lodge, too, is a place where you can give the only thing you have to give. If you give money, if you give goods, those are all things of the earth that have their own life. You may claim to own something, but that something really is from the earth and has its own life. So an Indian person would never claim to own a sacred pipe. But that pipe merely stays with us. We keep those pipes. They're relatives. They're related to us. They're part of the wholeness of creation. In the sweat, or in the sun dance, purification ceremony, or in the rite of vigil, you're giving back to the earth the only thing that is really yours to give. And that's the stuff here. Your own flesh and blood. Everything else is stuff that you may keep, but it's not really yours. So that the missionaries characteristically would say that Indians were engaged in this ritual in order, remember, to placate an angry god. And I'm going to end on this note and turn it over to Charles. There's none of that placating an angry god in any Indian tribe I know of that simplistically. In fact, participating in the sun dance or the Anipi or in the rite of vigil are merely ways of participating with the Creator. Ways that the Creator has taught Indian people, covenants that the Creator has with Indian people that are as important and as valid as the covenants the Creator has with Jews or with Christians. And we had to learn, I think, in this century that God did not forsake His covenant with the Jews in order to live this new promise, this new testament that was given to Lutheran, or for all Christians. That God still adheres to that old promise. Or maybe there are promises that the Bible never even talked about that God made to people around the world that are as good for those people as the promises God has made to us in Christ Jesus.